You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Did you ever wonder what really keeps the city ticking? I'm not talking about Wall Street, real estate, or the latest high-end restaurant. I mean, it's blood and bones, things like traffic lights, water, and waste disposal. Kate Asher's new book, The Works, takes us beneath the streets, through the circuits, and into walls to examine the systems that keep a city operating for an amazing look at everything that we take for granted. It's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Kate Asher to the show today. Hello.
Hey there.
Would this be true of every city, or if Chicago, Los Angeles, New York?
It's pretty much true of every big city around the world. The older you get, the more convoluted and interesting the systems are because they're older and they're often less visible, deeper underground.
In the case of New York, it's been said that one of our problems is that we've often been first or second. For example, our subway system is so old that that causes more trouble than if we had been rather late to developing one.
I think that's probably true. If you look, for instance, at Mexico City's subway system, it works very well, and they built it just like the Paris system and managed to learn from others' mistakes. But our subway system is a good example of one of the pieces of infrastructure in this city that is very, very old but still actually works very well. And you can imagine the foresight that would have had to go into it.
And considering the kinds of problems that we've seen with the London Underground, we did it better?
You know, it's interesting. There are certain things that we did that I think London didn't do. We got right the idea of having local and express trains, for instance. Now, I don't know whose idea that was, but that was a pretty clever idea. It lets you get across the city very, very fast. In London, there is, until recently, there was no way you could avoid certain stops. And it's an extensive system like ours and takes a long time.
Was there any particular question that got you interested in writing this book?
What really got me started on the book was after 9/11, there was an awful lot of pictures in the newspaper about what really happened under the World Trade Center site and why the power went down and the telephone system. And I realized
all of our telephone lines from this radio station, and that includes all the ones that were required for broadcast, were all under the World Trade Center.
That's right. Nobody really realized how much was under there. And as being a quasi-public servant, I knew part of it. And I realized that nobody else really knew it and went out to look for a book that would explain it and found there wasn't one. So I decided to write one.
Were there some areas of the infrastructure that were harder to research than others?
There were some entities that were more difficult to get information from. You'll probably not be surprised to hear that the MTA was not an easy organization to share information about the secrets of the subway system. And likewise...
Because of security concerns or just because they're secretive?
I don't know. Some of it was security. Some of it is just bureaucracy, and it's probably most bureaucracies, not particularly that one. Same thing with energy. Con Edison has a lot of safety and security issues, and so it was pretty tough to get the kind of information that we needed.
And Con Edison has been highly criticized in recent years for not always doing the best job. Recently got a rate increase, which has outraged some people.
Right.
Because they've done such a cruddy job, blackouts, and in some cases people have even been electrocuted. Well, I remember one person being electrocuted, but a couple of dogs being electrocuted on the street.
You know, I think of that every time I walk the dog, but to be fair to Con Edison, our system here is something like 99.98% reliable. If you go to many other world-class cities, and particularly if you go to second and third world country cities, you realize that it's not a given that the light should stay on. So I think people are critical because we have such high standards.
And because we have such a power need here, I don't know if there's any other city that draws as much electricity.
We have a power need for a couple of reasons. One, because our mass transit system, the subway, is dependent on it. But also, if you think of how many elevators there are in New York, we're really a vertical city. And when that power goes out, life for a lot of people in the city stops and stops dead.
We're also a walking city, a pedestrian city. And has that determined the way our infrastructure has been put together?
Well, in part, if you think about the sidewalks and the issues of space on the sidewalks and you think about how much is under the sidewalks, you realize that an awful lot of what you might see above ground in other places, telephone lines and other things that were once above ground in New York because of the density, is now under the streets. And when you see a hole in the street, you realize just how much is packed underneath.
Into the 40s, there were telephone poles everywhere.
Well, actually, in researching this book, one of the things I found out was that there was a very big snowstorm in the 1880s, and there was telephone wires and electricity wires that absolutely dotted the city. It looked like a spider's web of wires. And then after that blizzard, There was a move afoot to move them underground, and that's when they started moving underground. Obviously, some stayed above for quite some time.
What about the way our sidewalks and streets look? They're different in other parts of the world, and there are still some places in New York where there are cobblestones. Were cobblestones the first kind of paving of the streets?
Cobblestones were a very hardy paving, and they were actually stones that had come out of the ballast of ships that had required that when they were traveling across the ocean. So they were actually, it was actually a very practical use for the stone that they needed to get rid of. But some of those have lasted a very long time, but they're very expensive to maintain, and it is actually much easier to maintain asphalt now.
So why don't they just switch them all over? If you go to some areas, areas that probably haven't been as gentrified as others, like Red Hook, you still find cobblestone streets. And it's obvious not because they're trying to maintain some kind of old-timey feeling there.
Well, you should be surprised. In every corner of New York, there are people who are actually attached to them, attached to the sort of old-world feeling that they bring. So I
not
don't,
bike riders.
No, exactly. And probably not people walking barefoot either.
So at a certain point, we started ripping up the cobblestones, and we started ripping up the trolley tracks.
Right.
Or did we just cover them over?
Well, remember, there was trolleys at grade, there was the L's that were above grade, and over time, all of those things sort of went the way of progress. But remember that the way people originally got around was by horses and carts, and a lot of our streets really started out as carriage paths, and the stagecoaches were pulled by animals. So we've come a long way.
Why do you say that the cobblestones are hard to maintain? I would have thought that with all of the potholes that we see in regular asphalt, that would be the hardest to maintain.
Well, the cobblestones are expensive to reproduce and to keep the pattern going. They are actually durable in a certain sense. But if you actually want to, maintain the network that's there and the look and feel of them, they're actually different stones now than were used before. And it's a little bit of a mosaic exercise keeping them intact.
I don't know if this happens in other cities, but in Palm Springs, there's a button attached to the traffic light, and you hit that button, and within seconds, the light turns red. This is because there's not a lot of pedestrian traffic, but it allows the cars to keep on moving freely. But we have certain places where we push buttons, and I suspect that those buttons are attached to nothing.
You know, you're very, very smart. There's about 3,200 of them in New York City that are buttons that you're supposed to push to change the light. About a quarter of them work. Three quarters no longer work. So it's a crapshoot as to whether the one you're pushing works or not, and they don't remove them simply because they're expensive to remove.
But they just let them go out of action, but they haven't detached them. It's just
they let you play a guessing game. It's a little game that we're allowed to play if we push one of those buttons.
Then there's the whole matter of sequence lights. I always wondered about just how efficient that really is, because you could be zooming down Madison Avenue or Amsterdam Avenue, and sooner or later you're going to be caught by a light, even if you've played by all the rules.
You may or may not. I've actually found that. I live on the west side, and I found that on Amsterdam and Columbus. If you hit that, I forget what it is, 28 miles an hour.
That's the rule, 28?
I was told that. I'm not sure that's exactly right. It can obviously be adjusted by the traffic engineers, but that's what I was told. You can go, I have gone several miles without hitting a red light at that speed. But it all depends on what street you're on. They are managed very, very carefully, those lights. That's not luck. That is actually somebody's deliberate effort to keep the traffic flowing.
Now, there used to be a time when almost all those streets were two-way.
Right.
And now they're one way to make the traffic flow better?
The traffic flow better. It does make the traffic flow better. If you imagine this city as a two-way city instead of a city of one-way streets, you can imagine gridlock at almost every turn.
On the other hand, there are certain parts of the city, like Midtown Manhattan on the east side, where all the streets seem to be going west and none of them are going east. And you wonder what the heck that's all about. Or there are other places where you can't make a turn from, let's say, 42nd Street onto Madison. You have to go 10 blocks out of your way. I always wondered whether that was more efficient.
Well, you know, that was an experiment that's actually worked, those through streets. They've taken certain pairs of blocks and provided the ability to just go straight so that these turns don't hold up the traffic. And it actually increased the speeds on those cross streets. But the speeds are, of course, very slow. It goes up from about 4 miles an hour to maybe 6 miles an hour on average. So it's incremental progress, but it is progress.
We've started seeing new traffic signs for through streets.
Right.
Is this a unique thing to New York?
I'm sure we're not the first that have tried it. Most of these experiments have been tested at other places before they're brought to Midtown. But initially, there was, I think, four or five pairs of streets. And they actually have proved somewhat successful and became a permanent program as opposed to just a pilot.
My guest is Kate Asher, who's written a book called The Works, Anatomy of a City. It is published by Penguin Books. It's a large format book with lots of pictures. And you really do learn an awful lot about the stuff that you've always been curious about always wondered about. Well, here it is. You say in the book that sidewalks are rated in terms of pedestrian traffic. How many categories are there?
Well, it's really how many pedestrians in a given area on the sidewalk. And the more crowded are rated, the worse. And there's about five or six levels of service, it's called, and that really depends on how crowded it is and how many people are moving there at any one time.
So what finally comes out of all of that rating?
If you're building a new building, you're putting an apartment building, for instance, with, I don't know, I'm making this up, but a couple hundred apartments, you can pretty well guarantee that you're going to be increasing the level of pedestrian flow around that block, and you want to make sure that people can still move, that the streets aren't overcrowded and that the sidewalks are wide enough for those pedestrians to move on. So you do have to do those counts.
Who determines whether there are trees on streets? For example, 4th Avenue in Brooklyn, which is going through a revival. I'm assuming that any day now I'm going to start seeing trees there because that would change a lot of the feeling of that street.
Right. Well, the Parks Department is in charge of trees, and actually in the book there is an explanation of how you can go plant a tree and get a permit to plant a tree, and you can get the Parks Department to do it or you can actually do it yourself with the right permits. But that's all a Parks Department job, and they do it pretty well.
My brother wrote a book about how the waterfront used to be a key part of the city, and that as the city became much more business oriented, and we stopped using those piers the way we used to, we moved to Midtown instead. But what's happening with those piers? Who is maintaining them, and how many of them remain active?
The piers around the city.
Yeah.
Some of the piers are still used for commercial ship traffic, but it's mainly cruise traffic. There's a few piers that are still used for cargo, but most of them have either been torn down, fallen apart, or have been renovated as parkland.
Haven't a lot of there still are ships that unload cargo, but mostly in New Jersey these days?
There's actually a very big terminal in Staten Island, which is part of New York City that often we forget about, called Howland Hook. A lot of the port is in Elizabeth and Newark in New Jersey, and there is still an operating cargo terminal in Red Hook in Brooklyn.
There used to be all of these wholesale markets connected to the waterfront as well, and food distribution centers. Now all of those areas have become gentrified. Tribeca, the meatpacking district. Right. The UN is where there used to be a slaughterhouse. There's South Street Seaport replacing the old Fulton Fish Market. Have we moved everything to Hunts Point now?
You know, there's still a meat market in Greenwich Village on Gansworth Street. How long those businesses will last is anybody's guess. An awful lot is concentrated in Hunts Point in the Bronx. Bronx Terminal Market has fallen by the wayside. So there has been quite a lot of change over, you know, really over a century or so.
Doesn't that go against everything that environmentalists are telling us? Actually, wouldn't it be better for the carbon footprint if those distribution centers were closer to where the consumers are?
Well, it really depends how the stuff's coming in. If the stuff's coming in by water, that may or may not be a good thing. Certainly, it's better than coming in by truck. But if you think that some of the material is coming into Hunts Point by rail, which is actually environmentally probably as clean as you're going to get, it makes sense to aggregate those deliveries and bring them into one place instead of having large 16-wheelers coming down through Manhattan to individual markets.
What about air cargo? How much air cargo is shipped through New York?
Air cargo is huge. If you imagine all those tropical vegetables that we know don't grow around here about this time of year, you can imagine those planes coming in with lemons and oranges from Israel and Mexico and other places.
Now, one of the things that visitors to New York always seem to notice and New Yorkers don't notice is the steam coming out of the street.
Right.
What is that steam all about?
Well, it's very interesting because people know about the steam system. Sometimes they see the steam coming out of the orange cones and they think it's the actual steam itself. And that's really just vapor or water hitting the steam pipes. The steam pipes themselves are underground and are part of a central steam system that provides steam to institutions, to dry cleaners, to hospitals, and to a number of apartment buildings in the main core part of Manhattan.
So that steam is still an efficient part of the city's infrastructure?
It's a hugely efficient part. If you imagine that all those buildings and institutions would have to have boilers in every particular building. This way they just tap into a centralized steam system that comes from major steam production plants. So it's very, very efficient. Whether or not it can be brought out to the outer boroughs has always been a question because you don't have the density required to really justify it.
New York has a number of area codes in its telephone system, and now Manhattan has two or three different ones. There's not just 212, 646. I think there may be others as well.
Right.
We have a separate area code for cell phones. In fact, we have three or four different ones. Is that because we have so many telephones here?
Yeah, there we have just if you imagine just the growth of cell phones alone, and although some people have gotten rid of landlines, most people keep a landline and now have a cell line as well. So you can imagine how many more phone numbers there are now than before.
So is the infrastructure keeping up with the continually growing demand, or will the current economic downturn right things for a while and have all of these infrastructure people breathing freely, even if the rest of us are upset?
You know, the infrastructure people are really immune to those sorts of cycles. I mean, the people who are managing the sewers and managing the power lines and everything else are looking forward, constantly maintaining, replacing, and expanding the system. And their programs go over 10, 20, 30 years. They really are, you know, oblivious to what's happening in any given year or two. Those programs have to be maintained or the systems won't continue working.
Does the 311 system work, the 311 system?
I'm told it works terrifically well. I haven't called it lately, but apparently it's one of those few municipal, you know, call-in systems that actually has been critically acclaimed as a success, and I think that's because the mayor's put a lot of emphasis on it and a lot of resources into it.
Well, I would suggest that if you have been pushing one of those buttons to try to cross the street and nothing's been happening, you call 311
right.
And you complain. Before you go,
yeah.
Is there any infrastructure crisis that we should be concerned about?
I think the infrastructure crisis isn't necessarily New York City. The infrastructure crisis is more nationwide. If you remember, after that bridge in Minneapolis collapsed, everybody said we should have an infrastructure fund. We have to maintain our infrastructure. And they're absolutely right.
And now another one has just been spotted,
correct.
I gather, it was in the papers just the other day.
Correct. I saw that as well. And the bottom line is when there's an accident like that, there's a great hue and cry, but then there's no follow-up, and so no money's really been earmarked. No more money's been earmarked for infrastructure in Washington than had been earmarked before.
Well, I guess when we talk about earmarks, we're not talking about these kinds of earmarks.
Right.
Kate Asher's book, The Works, Anatomy of a City, is published by Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.